smattering of smashing, smoking, spitting, smiling smirkers. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 42, and of course, I am your humble host, Karen, and we are your school of scone scoffing scallywag scholars.
Nice. I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris.
This episode is, of course, brought to you by online menswear store Bonobos, the destination for best fitting pants, sweaters, jackets, and more. Celebrate the ho-ho-hos with some Bonobos over at Bonobos.com.
You're entirely pleased with yourself.
Yeah, wow.
Bonobos.
Bonobos. Extended 30% off sale items until the 23rd, so there's still time to score some bodacious bounty. And they also supply prizes for last week's Smarty Pants listener challenge. And it's time for me to reveal the answer. So the riddle last week was, tell me where I reside with Spot and Fido on my side. Seven peaks might be your guide under a regal hat that gleams with pride. And the answer is...
It is the Canary Islands.
Yes, you actually solved it, Colin.
I did. I have to admit, I mean, it wasn't solving as so much of a recollection. But so my path was, all right, where I reside, a flag with dogs on it. Spot and Fido by my side. I remember really learning that the Canary and Canary Islands is the same root as like canine, which is why there are dogs on the flags.
Not the birds.
Right, not the bird. So it was really more, I just happened to remember that. But yes, Canary Islands, dogs on the flag.
The birds are actually named after the island.
Mm.
Not the island named after the birds. So yeah, the Canary Islands are off the northwest coast of mainland Africa.
Just to finish, the clue that it was the seven peaks also pictured on the flag as well, right?
Yeah, and I think that's the tricky part because seven peaks, you'd be like, oh, it's mountain or some sort of a sharp object. But the seven peaks are actually, there's seven main islands in the Canary Islands. They all have volcanic sort of origins, so they're kind of like volcanoes. So seven volcanoes. So there you go. We've notified the listeners. And congrats to you guys who got the answer right. It was a little bit tough one.
Good job.
And today's episode is episode number 42. And 42 is...
The meaning of life.
The answer to life, the universe, and everything.
Yes. The answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Here's another interesting fact about the number 42. Do you guys know what antipodes are?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh no.
Yeah, they're like the opposite.
The opposite of the globe.
Yes. Right?
So you pick a spot, and the antipode is its exact opposite spot if you were to go straight through the middle of the Earth.
Yeah.
Yep. So in 1966, a mathematician by the name of Paul Cooper, he actually theorized that if you bore a straight hollow tube, like a hole, through Earth, and you took out all the air and lava,
and if you jumped through to the
other side, it would take 42 minutes, no matter what the two antipodes are. Yes.
That'd be a fun ride.
Would you decelerate as you're coming out the other side?
Well, you would accelerate toward the middle, right? And then once you pass the middle, you would slowly be decelerating, right? And they would virtually cancel out.
Correct.
It wouldn't be perfect, right? But they would almost cancel out, right?
The first half of the journey is basically free fall acceleration. But, you know, when you pass the center, then the second half consists of exactly equal deceleration. Hmm. So 42 minutes, no matter where the antipodes are.
If you can get around the problem of all that magma and swirling, yes.
And without further ado, let's jump into our general trivia segment, Pop Quiz Hotshot. Get your barnyard buzzers ready, and I have a random Trivial Pursuit card here. Let's do this. Blue Wedge. Oh, man, this is hard. Name two of the five German states that start with B. That was Colin.
Well, Bavaria, I believe, would be one.
Mm-hmm.
And, man.
Bonn? Is that one? Or is
that
not one?
That is a city.
Oh. Yeah.
Bismarck.
Bavaria is one. Berlin.
I censored myself. I was like, no, that's a city.
Brandenburg. Bremen from the folktale, and Baden-Württemberg.
Oh.
So those are the five.
All right. And Brandenburg, like the Brandenburg Gate.
Pink Wedge for pop culture. Who made her big screen debut in Sid and Nancy before garnering a Golden Globe nomination for The People versus Larry Flint? Holland.
Was that Courtney Love?
Yes. All right, Yellow Wedge. Eleanor Roosevelt appeared on which classic quiz show? Multiple choice. Mm. The $64,000 question. What's My Line? Or You Bet Your Life. I've never heard of any of these shows.
I will say it's What's My Line.
Correct.
I would guess that as well, yeah. With Groucho, right?
Yeah, that was where you had to ask people questions and they would to figure out what their line of business was.
Oh.
Right. So I'm sure they were quizzing her to find out that she was the First Lady of the United States.
All right, Purple Wedge. What is Shakespeare's shortest play? Colin.
I'm taking a step. Is it As You Like It?
Incorrect.
I don't know.
It is The Comedy of Errors. I wish this also told you what the longest play is.
Oh, yeah.
Green Wedge for science. If you were born in July, what's your birthstone? And I guess none of us are born in July.
I believe it is garnet. Or
no, that's January.
Is it ruby?
Yes, it is ruby.
My brother was born in July, and it was red, but I didn't know which it was. Ruby? Nice. Okay.
Good job. All right, last question. Orange Wedge. Wow. What position was left out of Abbott and Costello's Who's On First routine?
Shortstop.
Incorrect.
Oh, really?
I don't know.
Oh, geez. Let's see. They do Who's On First, What's On Second. I don't know. Who's his third base?
Right. Who is it? I don't know. Catcher. I'll guess catcher.
It is right field.
Oh, okay.
So the players were who, what, I don't know, I don't give a darn, why, because, today, and tomorrow. Good job. That was a tough one.
That's a good trivia question. Yeah.
In this week's episode, we're trying to gear everybody up with holiday spirits, and one of the best things about holidays is, other than vacation days, it's the food.
Yeah.
It's the eating. Mm-hmm. So today's show is all about holiday foods.
Happy New Year. Oh, bring us a figgy pudding. Oh, bring us a figgy pudding. Oh, bring us a figgy pudding and a cup of good cheer. We won't go until we get some. We won't go until we get some. We won't go until we get some. So
okay, well, I'll start us off with a holiday food quiz. So I'm going to describe the dish, and you tell me what it is.
All right.
Oh, the name of it.
The name of it. First one. Nuts, raisins, and spices held together with beef fat. Oh, they're a little bit gross, too.
Would this be mincemeat?
No.
That was my guess. Hold on.
Too.
Nuts,
raisins, and spices held together with beef fat.
Is it sugar plum?
You're very close.
It's not pudding, is it?
It's plum pudding.
Oh, plum pudding. Oh.
They used to call raisins plums.
Beef fat.
They actually use beef suet, which is the stuff that's around the kidneys.
Yeah.
That's what they use. to hold it together. Well, I mean, this is like centuries old.
Yeah, and you have it laying around.
Yeah.
All right. A sweet roulade of sponge cake and chocolate icing.
This Karen? Is a Yule log.
Oh. Yes.
Which is a rolled up cake that looks like a piece of wood.
Or otherwise known as a log.
A trio of fowl ensconced upon one another.
A turducken.
Yes.
Or a
Pandora's cushion.
That's right. Pandora's cushion.
A pie made with meat, beef fat, fruit, and spices.
Is mincemeat pie.
Yes, right. Colin. A medieval precursor to eggnog made with curdled milk and wine.
Curdled milk? Grog?
No, that's mulled wine.
Passette.
Yeah, P-O-S-S-E-T.
I've definitely heard of that. I did not know that's what that was.
Sounds real gross.
Whenever you involve the word curdling.
I mean, I've read it in like medieval setting books and things like that.
They moved on to eggnog and didn't look back. A dish consisting of custard, fruit, sponge cake, and whipped cream arranged in layers. Karen?
A trifle!
Yes. Fish preserved with lye that has been washed and boiled.
That's lutefisk.
Yes.
I love his music.
Ludicrous.
Cake made with currants, sultanas, and almonds, originally from Scotland.
Okay, I'm just going to... Not my answer. I'm just kind of freeform.
Go for it. Well,
sounds like panettone, which is Italian.
Yeah.
Or stollen, which is from Germany. Mm. What would be the Scottish version of this?
It's called a Dundee cake.
A Dundee.
Yeah. All right, a traditional Norwegian flatbread made with potato, milk, and flour.
Oh,
and
I know this.
The largest in the world is in Minnesota, actually.
Oh, God. What is it?
Starts with an L.
Yes.
Oh, what is it? I ate this at Disney World in the Norway Pavilion.
It's not like, it's like it's limping. What is it?
You're so cool. It's called lefse.
Lefse. Yeah. That's what it is.
Okay, and the last one. Potato pancakes, usually topped with applesauce.
Latke.
Yes. Latke. And
love
sour cream.
Latkes.
Good job, you guys.
So, Dana, you had mentioned earlier lutefisk, which is the Scandinavian fish covered in lye and sort of semi-fermented. I have a sort of related dish that I would like to talk about that's even one step beyond that in terms of craziness. This is the traditional Icelandic dish of hakarl.
Hakarl.
H-A-K-A-R-L. Hakarl.
Hakarl.
Which is essentially fermented shark. But the process is a little nuts. Okay. So hakarl is made with the Greenland shark. And the way you make the dish is you catch the Greenland shark first. So it assumes you have a Greenland shark.
Looks like that's the hardest part.
Step one.
Step one, acquire Greenland shark. Take the shark, you gut it, you clean it, cut off the head. You bury it in a hole in the ground, cover it up with dirt, and then you wait 2 to 3 months while it decomposes and putrefies.
Yep. Okay.
You come back, you dig it up, you take what's now sort of the remains of the putrefied shark meat. All the liquids would have drained off into this time and have been absorbed into the soil. You hang it up, you let it dry, and after it's dried, it sort of has this brownish rind on it. You cut off the rind, you chop it up into cubes, and then you eat it. And that's hakarl. Now, here's where it gets weird. This is reported to be...
That was
the normal part of this dish. It's reputed to be the worst-smelling food on the planet.
Oh, okay. I bet.
We've talked about durian. We've talked about lutefisk. This dish may actually take the cake for the most foul presentation. And part of the reason it's so foul has to do with the shark itself. So Greenland shark on its own is poisonous. If you eat it fresh, it would kill you because it has ridiculously high concentrations of urea, which is, it's what gives urine the ammonia smell. When it combines with water, urea turns into ammonia smell. Crazy levels of urea.
Poop's got to show up.
And a compound called TMAO, which is basically what breaks down into rotting fish smell. Huh. Like when fish goes bad, you're smelling TMAO that has converted. So the Greenland shark is high in both of these, so you can't eat it right away. Like, there are stories that if you eat it fresh, you can vomit blood.
Oh my God. So
what the fermentation does is it breaks down these compounds to make them safer to eat. When you eat it, it smells like urine.
So here's a question.
Yes.
Why even eat it at all?
Why? Well, you know, there are a number of theories that range from this is just a joke to be played on foreigners when they come to Iceland.
I could see getting as far as burying the shark so you never have to think about it again. It's the part 3 months later where somebody's like, hey, Ivan, you remember that shark we buried? Do you want to dig it up and hang it in the garage for whatever?
This is a traditional dish really associated with a midwinter festival in Iceland called the Thorsablot, named after Thor. So there is just a bevy of awesome, awesome quotes about hakarl. And this dish actually has the distinction of it's got the golden trio of celebrity chefs. Anthony Bourdain has covered it on his show.
Andrew Zimmern
has covered it on his show. Gordon Ramsay tried to eat it. Gordon Ramsay famously spit it back up, vomited it. Even he couldn't keep it down. Anthony Bourdain said it is, quote, the single worst, most disgusting, and terrible tasting thing he's ever eaten. And Anthony Bourdain has eaten a lot of things. Here's some quotes from other people. It's a little like a tuna fish sandwich that's been sitting on the bottom of your lunch bag for 3 weeks. It resembles a tramp sock soaked in urine. It tastes like someone pooped in your mouth after a bender.
Oh, jeez. Yuck.
And every guide I've read, you know, is like, if you're going to go try this for the first time, it warns you, be prepared to vomit, be prepared to drink heavily, just know what you're getting yourself into.
The pee you can chew. Who's getting hungry?
Whenever we listen to Christmas music, there's the wonderful song, We Wish You a Merry Christmas, in which the carolers tell the person whose house that they're caroling at that they please bring us some figgy pudding. Now, of course, all kids sing this song and nobody actually understands what figgy pudding is. So I decided this was the episode to do the research and figure out what figgy pudding is.
And
so,
not as I had known people thought it was finger pudding. It's not finger pudding.
Some finger pudding. So as it turns out, figgy pudding is pretty much just a variation on the traditional English Christmas pudding. We have a lot of listeners in the United Kingdom. You guys can just go to sleep now because you know all about this. The only entertainment value is to listen to Americans who've never eaten one of these in their lives talk about it. But everybody, you always have Christmas pudding at the end of your big Christmas dinner. And it is not, I want to really stress, like Jell-O pudding.
Right.
Like it is a conglomeration. Basically, what you do is you mix together in a bowl breadcrumbs, flour, sugar, and like all kinds of candied fruit and a lot of alcohol, a lot of rum and brandy, like a good deal of it. And you use beef suet, as we said, the fat around the cow's kidneys. And this goes back centuries upon centuries ago. Well, a lot of people in the United Kingdom would make these in around Europe. And you steam it. That's how you cook it all. But what you get is this sort of gelatinous mass. More bready, but like super soaked through with thing. After you steam it all through, you have to wait. Some recipes, it takes like a month minimum.
Oh.
One recipe that I found, they call for at least 3 months of putting it in the fridge and just waiting for everything to just all hang out and congeal and become as one.
This almost is like as a featured cheese in the popular cookbook from the time, Quick 3 Month Meal.
Yeah. One pot. Yes. 3 month meal.
What else are you doing with your time? Yeah. That's fine.
The preparation of this pudding has actually, of course, taken on a lot of traditions and superstitions as well. So some traditions say that you do it on Sunday, the Sunday stirrup, where everybody stirs the pudding. Some people say that you have to stir the pudding from east to west, which is the direction that the old wise men traveled to see Jesus. Some people say that your pudding has to have exactly 13 ingredients in it, one for Jesus and then one for each of the 12 apostles.
Awesome.
Some people say that the unmarried girls have to stir it or else they'll never get married in the next year. One of the recipe that I was reading said you can either just serve it as it is, and what you could also do is you could take a quarter cup of brandy, hold it over a flame until the brandy is on fire, then pour it while it's still flaming over the whole pudding and turn off all the lights and bring it to the table. And then once the brandy has gone down, that's when you can eat it. You can add coins to the pudding. People started adding coins into the pudding, and whoever got that slice won the coin.
Okay, I've heard about that.
But then it started becoming a little bit more symbolic. So it's like there were coins, but then they'd also put tokens in, like a thimble, which represented thriftiness or prosperity. So if you got the thimble, you would be the one who's prosperous that year. A ring. You might put a ring in there, and the ring would be for marriage. So as it turns out, figgy pudding is Christmas pudding made with figs. That just happens to have figs in it.
There's this really weird trend among holiday foods where you put items or collectibles or coins or whatever in your food.
A lot of these foods are for holidays around the end of the year, and these are very kind of like, you know, good omens or good portents for the things for the new year. Mm-hmm. And I can see them sort of tying in with a lot of superstitions.
I know there's the king's cake in French culture, and especially in the New Orleans area, kind of like a pie pastry cake.
A tartlet kind of
thing.
Yeah,
like a tartlet. Mm-hmm. And there's a ceramic baby Jesus in the cake.
Whoever gets
it is the winner. Jesus. During Chinese New Year, you eat dumplings. Sometimes there's a coin in it. And I remember this as a kid. What no one really thought about was you boil dumplings in really hot water to cook them. And then when you serve them, the ones with the coins are super hot and burn your tongue because they've been in boiling water. Yeah. And as a kid, I was like, I don't want the coin.
Right. It is funny how these traditions, you know, will stretch back from culture to culture to culture, and they'll be sort of analogs, and you can see how they grew up.
Yep. Yeah,
One of the things that as I was looking up holiday foods, I was thinking of looking up the origins of other traditional foods, and I only got as far as, you know, green bean casserole? Like, we had it during Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you take green beans, cream of mushroom soup, right, and then you get those French's fried onions. Yeah, right, you sprinkle them over the top, right? It would probably not surprise you in any way whatsoever to know that this was invented in 1955 by the Campbell Soup Company.
I can totally see that. It's like the grand age of casseroles and also the grand age of industrialized recipes.
Yep, like, oh my God, frozen green beans, canned soup,
preserved fried onions.
Yeah. Some people, I don't think they really know that now. Like, it's just sort of entered into the pantheon of traditional Thanksgiving recipes.
So one of the holiday foods I found that is very popular in the Midwest and the southern regions of America is Jell-O salad. And I've never heard of this before.
Yeah. Growing up as a kid, even, it's very 70s to me. Like, Jell-O salad just says so
70s. Yeah, 50s. I agree.
I found a recipe from Jell-O for a holiday treat or a potluck. It's called lime cheese salad.
Ah!
So you dissolve one package lime Jell-O in 1 cup hot water, then fold in 1 cup cottage cheese and 1 tablespoon mayonnaise.
Yeah.
Blend, chill until firm, unmold, garnish with salad greens, fill center with seafood salad.
Yeah. What?
Make 6 servings.
Kiddie pool. Wrestle.
As a kid, I'd be at parties and be like, Mom, why is this Jell-O cloudy? Jell-O's supposed to be transparent.
Yes, yeah. it looks like a virus outbreak because of the cottage cheese. And there's so many of these holiday Jell-O salad recipes I found in pictures of it. Some call for olives and Velveeta cheese. It's just so weird. And so I look back at, okay, where did this all come from, right? Before Jell-O was made, gelatinous entrees or desserts were a thing of luxury.
Mm.
Very complicated to prepare. Took a long time to cook, to mold it, and then to cool it, to set it. Actually, one of the weird things that they used as a gelatin substance was isinglass. Do you guys know what isinglass is?
It sounds like a Tolkien thing.
It sounds beautiful. It does.
It's from Rivendell?
The swim bladders of sturgeons or other fish. So they're like the floaty swim bladders that's kind of like the air pockets. And they would grind it down and dry it, and it would have some kind of like a sticky gelatinous characteristic to it. So in the early 1900s, the actual powder, like gelatin powder, was finally made. And it kind of changed hands. It wasn't really successful for a while until it met Orator Woodward, who has an awesome name. Orator Woodward. He also had little commercial success until he realized something, and this is early 1900s. Homemakers didn't know what to do with a food that pretty much is ready to serve and needed no recipes. All you have to do is mix it with water, and all of a sudden you have this gelatinous thing that sets. So here's the genius part. He gave people recipes. In 1904, Jell-O and his company distributed free cookbooks and booklets, like the green bean casserole thing.
Sure.
And so it was created to make an artificial need for this product. One of the Jell-O cookbooks published in 1922 is called Jell-O, America's Most Famous Dessert, At Home Everywhere. And it featured vignettes of like different lifestyles of people in America and how they enjoy Jell-O. And there's a fine line between like marketing and flat out lying or an inaccurate exaggeration, because they would have scenes of, oh, here are the Chinese immigrants working on the railroad. They love Jell-O. They put rice in their Jell-O. That's how they enjoy it. And they had scenes of the Inuit people of Alaska or near the Arctic Circle. They enjoy Jell-O this way. In mission country, the religious people enjoy Jell-O this way. The gypsies enjoy Jell-O this way. And obviously they're not true.
No.
No.
But who would know?
So really, Jell-O created this need for like elaborate gelatin dishes, and they're known as congealed salad or Jell-O salad.
Yeah. But, congealed salad is not a nice description.
No. And so by the 1930s, these Jell-O salads were all the rage. And it kind of coincided with the wartime attitude of using everything you got.
Yeah.
Things are rare. You have to save everything.
Yep.
Oh, here's this handy Jell-O packet. I'll put all my leftovers and mix it with Jell-O and make this giant food item that's a mix of everything. Entering into the post-war phase, they still had that mentality of, I have to save everything, but also they want something to look fancy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right? And that was the thing about Jell-O.
It's the visual appeal of
very fancy. So here's some classic retro congealed salad names. mint jello with capers.
Oh, why would you do that?
I guess it's like capers? Like mint jelly with lamb. Maybe.
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 Shredded wheat apple jello sandwich.
Wait. I was on board until the sandwich
shredded
part.
Shredded wheat and jello together? That's just like a textural nightmare.
Asparagus castle?
No. But I want to see it. It sounds like it would look awesome.
And of course, these got really elaborate. I remember seeing one of the retro recipes called for flaked fish or canned tuna that they would set in jello in the shape of a fish.
Which is kind of perverse.
Jello fish made with flaked fish.
At that point, just get a real fish.
Yeah, I know.
By the 1950s, these salads became so popular that jello responded by actually creating and putting out savory and vegetable flavor jello to make these salads.
Okay, because strawberry and tuna fish doesn't sound like it.
Most of the time they use lime. Like lime jello was the jello flavor to use for these savory salads.
Yeah, that's why they're. Okay. I think that's why they're sort of traditionally you see them in the green.
Mm. Well, let's good time to have a little break. A word from our sponsor as we muster up the courage to talk about food again.
It's where you go for brains and style. These pants are magic, they'll make you smile. They're hip, they fit, such wit, free ship. B-O-N-O-B-O-S. It's a no-brainer for gents to look dapper and sharp. So go bananas for bonobos. They're smart pants for smarty pants.
And we're back. Welcome to Good Job Brain. And this week we're talking about holiday foods.
Yeah.
Both delicious and gross.
Sometimes they can
be both.
And sometimes they can be both, depending on whom you ask. I want to go back a little bit, Chris. You know, you were talking about some of the traditional dishes from the UK. Mm. And I always feel like these old traditional English or Scottish dishes, just they have just so much character, maybe would be the word I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about haggis. So you guys probably have some rough conception of what haggis is, right? Anyone want to take a rough stab at describing what haggis is to me?
I can't. I think it sounds delicious.
Yeah? Okay.
It's made out of like a cow's, it's like a giant sausage, but encased in like a cow's or a sheep's stomach. And inside is like chopped up meats and like oatmeal and spices. Am I right?
You're fairly close.
That sounds delicious.
It is traditionally, it's a sheep's stomach. It's a boiled dish served in the sheep's stomach. And inside, you are right, there are spices and stuff. It's not just chopped up meats. What really gets a lot of people is that specifically what goes inside the haggis are the sheep's lungs and heart, and also usually the liver. So it's the inner organs.
You've got to like the gizzards.
You've really got to, so it's the lungs, the heart, the liver, oatmeal, as you said, some oats.
Great.
Our old friend beef suet from the top half of the show. Mm-hmm. It's minced together, that's cooked, and then, you know, a lot of spices and things like that as well. But that goes inside the sheep's stomach lining. You talk about non-photogenic foods. This would be a really good example of a non-photogenic food. It's just kind of like a brown mush coming out of a sliced open stomach casing.
How do you eat it? Do you get your own haggis
it's more of a communal food. So the haggis is without doubt strongly associated as a traditional Scottish food. The exact origin, it's a little hard to pin down, and even origins of the name aren't quite clear, but there's no doubt that it's associated with Scotland. References go back as early as the 1400s.
Wow.
So this is an old dish. Mm-hmm. One idea is, like a lot of these old traditional dishes, is it's you got to make the most of what you have, you know. And so this might be a dish that you're out on a hunt. You've just slaughtered a sheep, or you're hunting. You got to cook all this stuff right out in the field. Especially the inner organs are going to spoil the most quickly. So the idea is, what can you cook, you know, simply, quickly to preserve it, you know, and not waste anything. The holiday or celebration, I should say, that this is really associated with is a Burns Night Supper. And I don't know if you guys have had the chance, the privilege, some would say, to go to a Burns Night Supper, which is a celebration in honor of Robert Burns, the famous Scottish poet. After he died, friends and people wanted to honor him started having these celebratory dinners, largely because he wrote a very famous poem called Address to a Haggis. And so he is really kind of considered the father of marrying the haggis with the Scottish just nationalist, traditionalist pride. So I had the good fortune to go to a Burns Night Supper a few years ago. We had some friends, and it was an occasion, an elaborate sequence of events. It starts with a speech, a welcoming of the guests, guests, the host will usually give what's called the Selkirk Grace. I'm going to do my best here. I'm not going to affect an accent, but it's written in Scottish-style English. So this is the Selkirk Grace. Some hae meat and canna eat, and some wed eat that want it. But we hae meat, and we can eat, and say, let the Lord be thankit. We have it, and we can eat it, so let's go ahead and eat it. Thank the Lord. And then is the presentation of the haggis, which is brought in on a large plate, and it's big. So I mean, the first thing that struck me was, wow, that's bigger than I thought. You know, I was imagining these like little personal haggises.
Oh, yeah. A personal pan haggis.
Yeah, a mini haggis.
From Haggis Hut.
And if you're doing it right, you might have some bagpipes playing. Mm-hmm. And then you read the address to the haggis. The Burns poem, and I am not going to read it because it is quite long. As you read out the address to the haggis, there are actions that you perform.
The
signature action of the presentation is at the line, his knife see rustic labor dict, and you draw out as dramatically as possible a big-ass knife, and you stick it in the haggis, and you slice it open.
Awesome!
And it is visceral and kind of entertaining.
Yeah.
It's kind of scary, but very entertaining.
Wow, that sounds fun!
Let's do it!
Yeah.
This whole time you're also drinking, right?
Oh, yeah. This is... We've all been drinking. Yeah. I had some of the best Scotch whiskey, or just whiskey, if you prefer, that I ever had that night. Yeah. Nice. So we're drinking, everyone's happy, and I have to imagine that part of the drinking is to get up the courage to actually eat the haggis if you've never tried it before.
Yeah. It's like a party.
Yeah.
It really is a party.
Yeah. And so, of course, this being San Francisco in the 2000s, there was also a vegetarian haggis hand for those members of the party who were vegetarian.
A tofaggis.
Vajaggis. We tried tofaggis, and then we tried vajaggis, but then we just settled on vegetarian haggis.
It's for the best. It's for the best.
That's where less marketing is
better. It really guards against you doing anything cute with the name.
I can't believe it's not haggis.
Wait, so here's the question. What does it taste like? Did you like it?
I'm going to fess up. I did not actually try the real haggis.
What?
After all that?
No, I could not bring myself to try the real one.
You didn't drink enough scotch. I would be pumped up. I was ready to eat it right where you like take the knife and you slice it. It's like,
so this is funny. A lot of people, Americans in particular, have a real misconception about what this dish is. Mm. So about 10 years ago, a haggis company in Scotland surveyed 1,000 tourists. They found out that 33% of American tourists thought the haggis is an animal. Like, it is just an animal that you could go catch. I'm going to go catch some fresh caught haggis and eat it up. Right. If you have a traditional Burns night supper, it would be on the anniversary of his birthday, January 25th. Mm-hmm. So we had it sort of in the same holiday season.
It's coming up. We got a month from now.
We're going
to
do it.
Procure a haggis.
That's right.
A good job haggis party.
Yeah. And don't do what I did, which is wimp out and not eat the haggis.
Right.
Yeah.
So another holiday food item that I was curious about and felt like investigating was the Easter egg. Why are eggs associated with Easter? Well, Does anybody want to take a guess at this one?
Is this birth?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's one of those weird, it's one of these like hybrids where they took a lot of the pagan fertility,
It predates Christianity. Yeah, egg has been looked upon by many religions since the dawn of man as sort of like being representative of the universe and of birth and of life coming out of nothing. And of course, you know, the Easter celebration, in just as pagan religions' winter solstice celebrations eventually became Christmas, Easter, the spring celebrations became Easter. It's no coincidence it's all celebrated around that time. For Christians, the egg was sort of back interpreted to also be the tomb of Jesus.
Really?
And life inside that, you know, coming out of it. Yeah.
There was a lot of sort of the retconning when they would when they would sort of slam the two religions together.
Yeah. But here's the question. Why do we color our Easter eggs? Why do kids color Easter eggs? It's just fun. So this is why. Some of the earliest Christians, when they were first using the egg as a symbol of life and eating it during Easter, would stain them red so that it was the blood of Jesus.
Oh.
Yep.
Oh, Yum.
And so egg staining is a super, super old Christian tradition. So when you get your kids together and you color Easter eggs, you are doing something that Christians have done for 2,000 years. Who even uses real eggs anymore? Because now kids just have plastic eggs that candies are hidden in, and that's what they go on their Easter egg hunt
they
for.
They do?
Yeah. Well, we had those. I remember plastic
kids
eggs.
We never ate.
I mean, we would dye actual eggs. But we never ate them.
We used to have to eat a ton of egg salad after Easter, and it was like weird colored egg salad.
And yeah. So let's go even deeper on this. Why does the Easter bunny bring Easter eggs?
Well, I believe that's another, that the rabbit was a fertility symbol
They
procreate quite easily.
Yep. Hares, spring, fertility, life, you know, that all kind of goes around the same celebrations. But again, the idea of the bunny bringing eggs, this is actually not a corporate invented tradition. Like, this really does go back like centuries upon centuries, this idea of the Easter bunny bringing Easter eggs for the children. Okay, because this is good job brain, we should get into some of this science. Apparently this came into the U.S. I was reading via like at least some like Pennsylvania Dutch, you know, when they were kind of coming over from Germany, there was a word, I believe it's pronounced Osterhaus, which just means Easter hare,
as opposed to a rabbit.
Right. But hares, they have a lot of babies. They can get pregnant while they are pregnant.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, I had read that.
In late pregnancy, they can get impregnated, and the fertilized eggs will just chill out in a waiting area, basically, and just, like, wait until the room is clear.
It's like an on-deck circle.
Yeah. Yes, they're in the on-deck circle. And as soon as the hare gives birth, the fertilized egg's like, our turn. So you never not have to be pregnant. You can just be pregnant forever.
No.
And that is why
jealous ladies.
Yeah. And that is why procreating like rabbits, because they can just crank them out. They get a few ready. There's babies on deck. There have actually been a very, very, very few cases in history of what this is called superfetation in humans, where something will go wrong, basically, and a woman who is pregnant will get pregnant again.
Whoa.
But here's the thing. You don't know, because it happens very close to each other. You think you're having twins. And the only way they can tell is if they, after the babies are born, and typically what happens is one of them is premature. Not necessarily the second baby. Sometimes the first baby can go to term. Very, very, very few cases of women thinking they gave birth to twins and actually they got pregnant while they were already pregnant.
Wow.
And these are two separate pregnancies.
I've never heard of that. That's crazy.
Yep. Super rare.
I thought this episode was going to be like, oh, celebrate the holiday with delicious food. But now everything's kind of grossed out.
I knew that it was going to turn into weird and gross angles on foods. And I'm not disappointed at all.
No.
Okay. Well, we have one more final quiz today. Oh, I forgot to mention, we won an award a couple of weeks ago. We were nominated for the 2012 Stitcher Awards for Best Games and Hobbies Podcast and also Best Album Art.
Yep.
And we attended the very fancy event hosted by Stitcher here in San Francisco, and we had a lot of fun. I think we had the most fun.
Oh, yeah. We had a great time.
That happens to us a lot of places, though.
We met some very nice Good Job Brain fans. You know who you are. Thank
Absolutely.
You so, so very much to you guys for coming up and saying, this was the first time that we had ever actually met any Good Job Brain fans who are not like our moms. So it was great.
Face to face. It was great.
It was so much fun for us. So thank you guys for saying hello.
Yeah, and we also provided entertainment for the award ceremony, and we did some live trivia on stage. It was fun, and we just met a lot of cool fans and peers. Colin and I actually met a couple people from Decode DC, which is a political podcast, very famous.
We were out to lunch with them, and they found out that we ran Good Job Brain and were involved in a trivia show. And immediately, one of the women was like, oh, can we do trivia right now? I have a quiz for you guys. And so, of course, Karen and I were like, yeah, we can do trivia. And so she proceeded to ask us, all right.
This is within seconds
of meeting this woman. It was great. And so she asked us a question, which I will ask you guys just in 1 second.
Oh, okay.
And that will be the first question in a quiz that I have prepared for you guys here. So get your buzzers ready. So this quiz is going to be about geography, specifically country names. So all about names of countries and what they have in common, maybe what they have different. So here's the question that Lena asked to me and Karen. And I would like to brag that she told us that we were the only people who had successfully answered it. So
that wasn't even a humble brag.
There's no humble here.
No,
that was a braggy brag.
All right, so this is a question that you guys can work on together jointly. There are 10 countries in the world whose names are 4 letters long.
Okay.
And when I say names, I mean their common name. I'm not going to, you know, trick you.
The Republic of? Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So the common name that people call these countries. 10 countries whose names are 4 letters long. Why don't you guys see how many you can name?
Well, okay. Let me start with Africa.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Yeah. Do whatever you want.
Mali, M-A-L-I. Togo, T-O-G-O. Chad, C-H-A-D.
All right.
Peru.
Yeah, Peru.
Oh, good.
Fiji.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
Cuba.
Yep.
I would add Iraq and Iran.
Yep, yeah. The two good ones right there.
And Oman.
Oman, the only country whose name begins with an O.
Correct. You've got 9. There's one left. Right. It is an Asian country.
Okay.
Laos.
Laos. Yes.
And that's it, huh?
And that is it. Those are the 10. Technically, Laos, their name is the Lao People's Democratic Republic. And in fact, they specifically asked the United Nations not to call them Laos anymore. So that's the only reason it's a little unclean. And for a bonus question, can you guys name the one country that used to have a 4-letter name but no longer does?
Siam.
Yes, ooh. Siam, wow. Which nice. Is now Thailand. Whoa. Good job, Chris. Now we're going to get into the meat of the quiz here and kick it up a notch.
All right.
There are, of these countries, 3 of them whose capital city also has 4 letters in the name. Can you guys name any or all 3 of those? Karen.
Lima, Peru.
Lima, Peru is definitely the easiest one.
Oh, I think Fiji as well, but I forgot what the
city was. Yeah, you're right.
It
is. The capital of Fiji is Suva.
Suva. Oh, yeah. S-U-V-A.
S-U-V-A. And I will be very impressed if any of you guys got the last one. It is actually Lome, the capital of Togo. So Lima, Peru, Lome, Togo, L-O-M-E, accent E, and Suva, Fiji.
Wow.
So that's a good trivia within a trivia question.
Yeah.
There are 2 pairs of countries who are what we call substitution neighbors, meaning that if you change one letter in the name of the country, you get the name of the other country. So can you guys name the 2 sets of countries that fit this description?
Well, the first ones are, of course, Iraq and Iran.
Those are the easy ones. Yes.
Oh, they're like one letter off.
One letter off. Yeah. There is one other set of country names where if you change one letter from one name, you get the other country. Purely coincidentally, like Iran and Iraq, this other pair also starts with the letter I.
We can get this. We can get this.
Say it.
Ireland.
Say it. Yes.
And Iceland.
Correct.
Oh, yeah.
Ireland, Iceland, Iran, Iraq.
Huh.
Nice.
Yeah. There are 6 countries whose name ends in the letter U.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to challenge you guys because I know you guys can do this. I need you guys to name 5 of these 6 countries.
Ends with a U.
Okay.
Well,
country
Peru.
Name ends in the letter U. That's
so we
right.
Got Peru.
So Peru
there.
Actually is on both of these lists. That's right.
Okay. Macau?
No. Macau would be a region, and there are a lot of regions. Ooh. So these would be, you know, sovereign states, members of the UN.
Okay. Timbuktu?
Nope. No. That would be an old name. That would be an old name, yes.
Yeah. Vanuatu.
Correct.
Ooh.
Vanuatu.
Tuvalu.
Tuvalu,
okay,
yes.
Wait a minute. These are all seasons of Survivor.
Uh-huh. There's another season of
Palau?
Survivor, yes.
Palau.
Oh, man.
Guinea-Bissau.
Oh, Guinea-Bissau.
Guinea-Bissau. I thought, you guys would get that one. And then the last one is Nauru. But that was good. You guys got 4 out of the 6. All right. This part of the quiz is called Snow White and the 7 Stands. There are 7 countries that end in Stan, S-T-A-N. And of course, if you don't know, Stan means linguistically land of.
Okay.
So I'll give you one. Afghanistan is land of the Afghans.
Okay.
Karen. And you guys can do this collectively if you want.
Okay. Kazakhstan.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Kyrgyzstan.
Yep.
Pakistan.
Pakistan.
Yep.
Turkmenistan.
Yep.
Tajikistan.
Yep. And one more. Afghanistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan.
Uzbekistan.
Yes. So I had asked you about countries that end in the letter U. I'm going to give you guys letters. There is only one country that ends in the following letters.
Oh, okay.
I will give you the letter. You guys buzz in quickly and give me the country. So, for example, if I were to say Q, a Middle Eastern country, you would say...
I have no idea.
Iraq.
You would say Iraq.
Oh,
right.
Oh, okay.
All right. This Asian country ends in the letter H. Dana.
Bangladesh.
Bangladesh. Oh. Correct. The only country in H. This European country ends with the letter K. Karen.
Denmark.
It is Denmark. Oh. This European country ends with the letter G.
Hungry. I was going to say Hamburg. Hungry.
Massive. Say smaller country.
Luxembourg.
Luxembourg. Oh. Yeah. Yes.
Very good.
So instead of last letters, we're going to focus on first letters here. I want you guys to tell me what are the only two letters that do not begin a country name. And for the purposes of country name, we'll take the United Nations here.
Okay, it's not
so
Q.
So for example, right, there's Q for Qatar.
Qatar, Z, X. Zambia.
X is one of them, Dana, that's correct. There are no countries that start with the letter X. What is the other one?
W.
It is W.
Yes!
Absolutely right. Huh. There is a Q, there's Vs, there's Zs.
No, J's.
J's.
West Germany used to be the W.
Would have been.
Yeah.
Yes, these are current listings.
Yeah.
All right, well, good job, guys. That was meant to be a little bit tougher, but I think any one of these could overlap with some good trivia questions.
Poof.
Good job.
It's like smoke coming out of my ears. All right, and that is our show. Thank you guys for joining me, and thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learn a lot about Peru. Peru's very popular. Fish that taste like urine, jello dishes, and all of these festive things that we talked about in this episode. You can find us on Zune Marketplace, on iTunes, on Stitcher, and also on our website, which is goodjobbrain.com. And don't forget to check out our sponsor, bonobos.com, and we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Later.